Welcome to Berlin Review Audio. This episode features acclaimed novelist and essayist Tash Orr in conversation with Berlin Review publisher Tobias Haberkorn. It was recorded on November 30, 2024 at the DAAD Galerie in Berlin as part of the event Solidarity Capture Treason. The discussion explores themes prevalent in Tash's writing, such as shame, class, language, and migration, weaving together personal memories from Malaysia with reflections on transnational identity, queerness, and the complexities of social mobility. We will also hear an early draft of Tash's forthcoming essay titled Traitors, which will be published in the fourth reader of Berlin Review, coming out in early July 2025. A big thank you to the DAAD Galerie, and now enjoy the talk.
Yes, and now Tash, how are you?
Very well. Thank you, Tobias. And thank you, everyone, for coming. I know Saturday night in Berlin, there's so much going on. And yeah. So it's really nice that you've chosen to come here for at least part of the evening.
Actually, my question, how are you, was a bit of an inside joke, because we just had a conversation on how bizarre this question is from a transcultural point of view.
Absolutely. And I responded in the way that deflected it so that you don't know how I'm actually feeling.
The British way.
Yeah.
This is part of your biography. You were born in Taipei, actually, mm-hmm. in Taiwan, moved back to the place where your parents grew up,
mm-hmm. Malaysia,
in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, as a two-year-old, I've read. But your grandparents, I think, were immigrants to Malaysia from China.
Exactly.
Yeah. And this is also an important part of your writing.
Yeah.
So Tash is a novelist. His first novel came out in 2005, I think, won him directly a few awards and got him on the Booker Prize nomination. And it's an historical novel set in the 1940s in Malaysia. And I believe it's modeled on your grandfather,
exactly,
the shopkeeper.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so it's a great book. It's translated also into German and many other languages. And after that, you published four more novels?
Three. Right. Three more novels and a memoir.
And a memoir that's Strangers on a Pier. And by the way, the German translation has been published first in 2016 in an extended version then in 2021. Okay. And the German translation is just out at Luchterhand Verlag. The topic of tonight's talk, Capture, Solidarity and Treason, the part that was mostly inspired by you and a conversation we had like 6 months ago, is on treason, because you have a few things to say or a few points to make about, yeah, what's up with treason, let's say, in the landscape of identities mm-hmm. that we all navigate and that are so much in the focus of cultural production as well. And I think to get it going, you have prepared, so you're writing, and that's really great news for us. You're writing a text for Berlin Review. It's in the making. And you're going to read a passage from the beginning of this upcoming essay. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I think you're right. I'm just going to read a passage, a long essay that I'm writing for the Berlin Review on the theme of treachery and what it is to be a traitor without really even doing anything. We have come to believe that truth and knowledge of the self are inseparable, that each is a necessary condition for the other to exist, and together they produce the means for us to live harmoniously with others. But what if the opposite is true, that knowing who you are requires you to be deceitful, and that this very deceit is a prerequisite for living within your society? We are on a bus, my mother and I, speaking about something banal, what we need to buy at the market, how to organize our day, that sort of thing. It's one of those months when money is tight, my father is away trying to find work, and at home my mother is tense and uncommunicative, stretched thin by having to do the housework and raise the children on her own. This is not unusual. We have grown accustomed to periods like this when a veil of stress settles silently over the household. My mother is troubled, describing a list of things we need to buy, calculating how much each item will cost. She's speaking to me in Hokkien, our southern Chinese dialect, inherited from her parents and their parents before them. Maybe she is a bit more agitated than usual because her voice is occasionally raised, and as sometimes happens in these situations, I become self-conscious, even slightly embarrassed. She asks me a question and I nod, preferring not to speak, because we are in a public space where the national language is Malay, and we know that to speak in our language is to mark ourselves as different. And not just different, but dangerous. I'm 10, 12 years old, I can't remember exactly, but old enough to realize what it means to be born of an immigrant family. On May the 13th, 1969, racial riots broke out in Malaysia, mainly in Kuala Lumpur, the capital, following general elections when opposition parties representing equality for all ethnic groups in the country made unexpected gains. The pogrom that followed resulted in the murder of hundreds of ethnic Chinese Malaysians, the culmination of more than two decades of anti-Chinese sentiment that stemmed from the communist rebellion that lasted from the Second World War until after the country's independence in 1959. During those years, Chinese communist fighters led a guerrilla campaign against the British colonial administration aimed at securing equal rights for ethnic Chinese Malaysians born in the soon-to-be independent colony of Malaya, rights that did not and still do not exist. When the killings occurred on May 13th, 1969, my elder sister was just 2 years old. My parents had just left the provinces to live in Kuala Lumpur at the time, and having a small child made them acutely aware of the dangers of being Chinese. By the time I was born 2 years later, none of this was spoken about. My parents wanted us to behave as though we were just the same as any other Malaysians. We rarely spoke Chinese in public. We never talked about our political beliefs beyond our closest friends or relatives. But occasionally, like on this bus, in this moment with my mother who is stressed, we slip up. And what overcomes me is a feeling of shame, more than terror. In public, we learn to hide who we are, to be, in effect, deceitful. Everyone can see we are different, of course, but identity is more than just skin color. It is how you declare yourself to the outside world. You have to be constantly vigilant to maintain a lifelong declaration of fidelity to the country you live in, to the idea of a nation. And this means downplaying the most essential elements of who you are, as if you aren't aware of them. Language, ancestry, even your name. I'm not a teenager. I've not even heard stories of communists and betrayals, and yet I feel like a traitor just by speaking the language that I share with my parents. It is an inherited shame. I will discover this later. But right now, it feels that just to be who I am, a Chinese, an immigrant, is to be somehow a traitor, and I don't want to be that. The language and culture in this case is Chinese, but it could be Turkish, or Vietnamese, or any other immigrant language in any other country, in any period of time, and the sense of shame and treachery will be the same.
Thanks. Thank you, Tesh. So you're describing a situation where one of the basic elements of shame is the language that you speak in public. You grew up in a very multilingual setting. Can you explain that a little bit to us?
Yeah, I mean, it's very simple. I think, you know, in Europe, people take being multilingual as a sign of cosmopolitanism. But for most people, especially, you know, if you come from a slightly more working class background, as I do, it's a question of survival. So especially in a country like Malaysia, where the national language is Malay, so everyone speaks Malay. At school, we do all our studies in Malay. But if you come from a Chinese-speaking background, so an ethnic Chinese family like mine, your grandparents speak Chinese. I mean, they arrived from China, you know, and so that is their main language. And to communicate in any other way seems very artificial. So they speak to us in Chinese, and we respond likewise. It just, there's no other way to speak to them. If you want to keep some kind of intimacy with your family, that's what you have to do. Mm-hmm. Outside of the household, we spoke Malay, but also English is a second language because Malaysia is an old British colony. And it also happens that English is the language of the bourgeoisie, which is why I really wanted to be good at English so that I could escape my family circumstances and work in a language that's a bit more neutral.
Mm-hmm. And how is school, the teaching in school is done in both Malay and English?
No, it's entirely in Malay.
Okay.
Apart from English lessons.
Okay, but one of the things you're describing in Strangers on a Pier is how extremely focused, everyone in your schools, in your high school, was on going on to pursue higher education in Singapore or in American elite universities or British universities. So that is an impact of the, well, former empire, the British Empire or the American Empire today, that to a certain extent we all, even in Europe or Germany, are feeling. So English has a certain prestige.
So there's two things. In Strangers, what I describe in Strangers on the Pier is how half the people or a proportion of people were very obsessed with escaping their backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so society was really divided into two, between those people who basically came from middle-class backgrounds mm-hmm. and for whom education was possible. They saw the value of education. They had antecedents, or they could have some kind of a model that showed them what education could do for you. And on the other hand, you had people who were left behind, whose parents worked in factories, who worked in blue-collar jobs, who didn't see the point of education. So very quickly, in a country like Malaysia, where there was a lot of social mobility in the 80s and 90s, you had society separating. So yes, one part of the school became very... It became very sort of obsessed with the idea of escaping their circumstances, and mm-hmm. the other half just couldn't.
One of the points that we have in common is that we've both... You live... in Paris currently. Now you're on a fellowship for 1 year at the DIID, but you moved to Paris a couple of years ago after studying in the UK and living a couple of years in London, right? So I also lived a number of years in Paris, and we are both friends and collaborators with Didier Ribon and Edouard Louis, who have written on class from the French perspective, and they've very much been read also here, and many people rightly to a certain extent transpose the mm-hmm. situation they describe from France to a general societal, let's say, structure that we also have in Germany. What struck me about your descriptions of the question of class, I mean, you have this element of being a Chinese immigrant. That's a very important mm-hmm. concept or status that you describe. And other than that, in terms of the class structure of society, for example, you at a certain point you say that you're from a country that has never developed a bourgeoisie. So my impression, actually, of the social dynamics that you're describing is that it's such an upwardly mobile and focused society. Maybe that has to do with a sort of like very quick development from an agrarian society up until the 1950s and 60s to something much more technologized and highly capitalist today. Also, so a development that would have taken 150 years in Germany happened in the space of 30 years there, or that's at least something I know about Korea, which I've got more knowledge about, if that's comparable. So that creates a class society regardless, but one where certain elements of, for example, working class identity seem to be absent.
I think it's very important to make the point that it has never had a bourgeoisie until now. Mm-hmm. And so what you have is a rapid evolution of these societies, which comes from the huge economic boom immediately after the end of colonialism. Mm-hmm. So it's also important to realize that France and Germany do not have the same experience of colonialism. So in the 60s, when a lot of these Southeast Asian countries become independent, what you have is a real freeing of the economy, and you have a real freeing of a sense of social mobility. But what happens when you have social mobility is also that you have very quickly a class system. So now, in just one generation, you do have a class system that actually resembles very closely what you have in an economic sense. You don't have all the cultural snobbery mm-hmm. yet. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you an example. So I went to what I described in my book is the experience of going to school in Malaysia. Because there were no private schools, there were only just one type of school, which were very bad, very badly staffed government schools run mm-hmm. by the government. So if you wanted to send your children to school, everyone had to go to the same school. So you had quite rich people at school with very normal people, with people who couldn't read, mm-hmm. and certainly whose parents couldn't read. So this produces a certain dynamic. The people I went to school with, who managed to get middle-class jobs, now every single one of them sends their child to a private school, mm-hmm. where the language of communication is English, and where they're studying about world history, they're studying all kinds of things that we didn't have access to.
Yeah.
And so in a family like mine, which is basically split between, so I grew up half in the capital and half in the countryside, what you have is people whose children are basically like me with a university education and therefore cannot communicate with the rest of their families, not because we don't have the language, but we don't have the shared experiences of life. Mm. You know, I'm here doing a talk in Berlin. My first cousin is working in a factory in small town Malaysia. Mm. So when I see them, you know, in February for Chinese New Year, what are we going to speak about in common? And these are people I grew up with. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent every single school vacation with them. I spent months and months and months of my childhood with them. Mm. And when I see them now, there is nothing I can talk to them about.
Mm. Is that where treachery comes in, where you feel like a traitor to your...
Yeah, absolutely.
To your family or to the class you grew up in?
Totally. I feel like a class traitor. Mm. I have this even with my parents. I mean, I keep having these arguments with them because I just, there is no... It creates a sense of frustration. You know, one of the people I mentioned in my book is Alice Walker, you know, the great American writer, who wrote a very powerful essay in which she called My Father's Country is the Poor, and how she describes the feeling of dislocation after just one semester at college. So she goes away to college, she comes back, and she finds that she can no longer communicate with her father mm-hmm. because he's illiterate. And he is a clever, sensitive, funny man with whom she has enjoyed closeness. And suddenly she finds she doesn't have the means to communicate with mm-hmm. him anymore. Mm-hmm. And this is why so often I think of social mobility. And people always talk about the great things about social mobility. Of course, you know, there are great things. Mm-hmm. But I'd rather be here doing a talk in Berlin than working in a factory in small town Malaysia. I mean, I don't want to romanticize the reverse. But what it does happen, and it's a very curious thing that you see a lot of in immigrant families, which is that the parents want their children to achieve a certain kind of life. They want them to have an education. They want them to read books. They want them to have a kind of middle class job.
That's a very interesting aspect, because I was thinking when I was reading about these passages, clearly so from the part of your parents, there was an expectation that you would become, that you would grow to do other things than them in life, that you would have a different life, that you would move away, etc. And they were also pushing you to pursue higher studies, right?
Yeah, so they always hoped for me to have higher studies, to, you know, to carry out higher studies, but I'm not quite sure they realized what this would involve, mm-hmm. or maybe they did. And if they did, it makes the whole situation even more poignant, mm-hmm. you know, even a little sadder, because it means that everyone is colluding in this dynamic where the more the children are able to achieve what the parents want them to achieve, mm-hmm. the more distant they will become.
But this is a difference to, again, the examples of Edouard or of Didier Eribon, and of other class narratives, of which we've had quite a few in the last 10 years also in Germany. And to a certain extent, I would also confirm this from my own upbringing, is that there's much more, it feels, in Germany or in France, an expectation from parents that you will become like them, even if, or maybe even especially so, if you are from a very modest or poor background, thinking about the books I mentioned. So I'm wondering, like, where this element of, like, parents pushing their children to become something else is coming from. Is it something that has to do maybe with the post-colonial situation? So a very young state, a very young society in the sense of like its autonomy. Does it have to do with the immigrant background that family from two generations back?
I think it's to do with immigration. Yeah. I think it's to do with the experience of being an immigrant, of escaping something. No one is an immigrant just for fun. You know, I mean, people are immigrants for a real reason. Contrary to what the right-wing narrative is, no one leaves their country just for they kind of think they might have a slightly better job somewhere else. I mean, no one goes through that pain. No one goes through that upheaval. You do it because it's absolutely necessary. And what that means is that you're already emotionally primed for great emotional upheaval. You're already primed for the fact that your children, when they go to university, will come back to you and actually feel that they're totally superior to you. But that is actually what you wanted all the time. You mm-hmm. want to somehow, that feeling of that parents have, that, you know, my own parents have, that feeling of slight humiliation is already built into the experience. And I don't think it's so dissimilar to the class experiences in Europe. Because, you know, sometimes when I speak to my father, and, you know, we talk about things, the fact that he doesn't know certain things makes him embarrassed. It makes him embarrassed to be talking about those things with me because he doesn't have the knowledge. So actually, in that way, the experience of masculinity, the experiences of shame, all those, I think, remain the same. But I think the tolerance for it is somehow built into the experience of being an immigrant. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think the passage I read, all those things that you have, the fact that you speak to your children in one language and they reply to you in another is a humiliating thing in some respect. It's basically saying to your parents, your language is not good enough. Your language is embarrassing. Your language is kind of slightly shameful. Mm-hmm. And I don't want this. So, you know, all those things feed into the idea of it's being a sense of just simply being a traitor, I think, is not too strong a word.
Would your parents then also see you as a traitor? Because they were the ones that in the beginning were sort of like, pushing you away,
yeah,
pushing you up.
Because I don't think they knew what this would involve. Okay. You know, when I forget how to address someone who is the second uncle of a cousin, you know, these are very important things to them. They're not important to me anymore. I mean, I once knew how to do this. And I don't think people realize what it means to be so detached from children until it happens. Mm-hmm. And then it's too late.
So this detachment, I suppose, in your case, happened when you went to the UK to study at Cambridge University, right? So you got a scholarship out of high school, and then you went on to study English and later law in the UK.
Yes, I would say it started even earlier when I knew that I wanted to do something with my life. I also think there are a lot of other factors. You know, I think also sexuality has a role to play in this. You know, if you're 12, 13, 14, and you know you're queer, and you know that actually you need to have space for yourself. And the only, you know, I couldn't play any sports well enough to, you know, to have a famous career elsewhere. So the only way out for me was to be good at school. Mm. And to read books. And the problem with reading books is that it changes the way you think. It changes the way you speak. It changes the way you see the world. And so my separation from my family started very early. My sister was exactly the same.
What is she doing today?
She's retired, but she's a lawyer.
Okay.
And so the separation is very early. I don't think it just automatically happens. I think it occurs over a long period.
Mm-hmm. There's another aspect with regard to shame that I found quite compelling in your description of your, also in the passage that you read in the beginning. It seems like you're coming from a post-traumatic society also, where trauma is repressed, where anything from showing weakness is sort of like taboo, you don't speak about emotions, etc. And I have to say, in a certain way, this reminded me again of a sort of like personal ethics of my grandparents. Mm. So in a way also the post-war, certainly German society is a post-war, post-genocide, and in that sense also a post-traumatic society. So can you see elements now that you've lived many years in Britain and then in France or in Europe, you've come to know your way around a little bit? Would you say there are points of comparison?
Yeah, there are certainly similarities about the awkwardness, the unease, talking about turmoil or conflict. I mean, the difference is I think Germany was not, I don't think was the victim in necessarily in the war. And I don't think Britain was necessarily the victim in the war and not even France. Whereas I think most ethnic Chinese people fleeing massacre and I think they were really the victim. So actually the dynamic is slightly different when you don't want to talk about being the victim. It's different from just a general unease at being involved in conflict. What my parents and grandparents didn't want to talk about was the specific experience of having been persecuted, the specific experience of having been seen as people who were poor, dirty, dangerous, treacherous to the country. So all these things are very specific experiences. So the fact that they didn't want that to exist in any way in our identity was, I think, very interesting to me. I mean, I find it now very interesting, but at the time I just felt this really bizarre because, you know, obviously you'd look the way you look and it's very difficult when people tell you, you know, your parents are telling you you're just the same as any other Malaysian. I mean, you're just no difference between you and anyone else. Mm-hmm. And then you go out on the street and people are telling you to go back to China. I mean, when I was 5 or 6 years old, someone told me to go back to China. I really literally did not know that they were talking to me. I thought they were talking, there must have been a tourist. You know how the child's mind invents things. I thought they were talking to a tourist who just happened to be walking by and who missed his plane to go back to Beijing or somewhere. It's just when it happened several times, time after time, that I thought, okay, right, now they mean me. And the way you think of yourself is so much influenced by the way other people think of you, that your internal logic, your internal identity becomes inseparable from the logic that is the external logic that is imposed upon you.
So I guess you speak also a lot about silence and all the things that have not been talked about either in your family or maybe in the culture at large. So I suppose getting to all these topics and investigating them and then being able to write about your family in a not fictionalized but memoir way must have been a process of uncovering, having certain conversations you never had, initiating a lot of things, breaking a lot of silences. Can you talk a little bit about that? How you went about going that and how much time it took you maybe to even start it?
It took years and I mean decades before I felt that I could speak to my parents in this way. It was really until I was really some way into my writing career that I could then use my books and my professional career as a kind of a mask to say.
Well, because interestingly, your first novel, which I've read last week, is very much about the questions that you're already working on now, are already present there.
True, yeah.
But it's also, maybe we shall say, published in 2005. And back then, the literary world was not as focused on the memoir genre as it is today. But it's in a certain romanced, fictionalized, tale-telling way that you tell the story of your grandfather, right? But,
and also, I don't think I was ready to do it in terms of memoir. I don't think I was ready to confront it with the directness and the honesty of a little memoir. So it took me, you know, a long time. And I said, well, actually, you know, this is not because I really want to know this, because I think they would have felt very threatened. I said, it's for research, it's for books. And so that's where it made things easier. But still, after many, many attempts, it was just impossible to get any answers from them.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, you know, I wrote this memoir thinking, it's going to be like any other memoir. I'm going to find these answers and I'm going to, you know, have this beautifully shaped memoir that starts with a problem and ends with all the problems being answered. And then we all cry and we all have a hug. Except it really didn't turn out that way. They didn't give me anything. They just couldn't, even when they said, okay, yes, we'll tell you. Let's sit down at 3 o'clock this afternoon. They couldn't speak. They were hampered, hamstrung by decades of not being able to say anything. So the book is really about silence. Mm-hmm. It's really about the inability of immigrant families to unpack all that they've lived through because they are so programmed to keep it quiet. Mm-hmm. So what they give you is only, it's a highly edited, highly filtered version of what they want you to hear. So they retain all that is the most traumatic is retained. And that's why so many people from immigrant backgrounds feel very deracinated, because you don't have the celebration of the family history, because there's nothing to celebrate except pain, persecution, fleeing something, poverty. So all those things, I can understand why people might want to hide this, but it still leaves the next generation with a story that is really highly incomplete.
So the society that you encounter when you come to Europe is the British society, the English society, and there are quite some funny passages and insightful passages on that in your book. And one of them concerns specifically the topic of the family and of working through one's upbringing, which is something that also white people do. And there's this funny passage where you narrate a conversation you're having with an English person, and I'm reading like a short passage from the book. It was only recently, with the help of therapy, that she'd come to realize the obvious. So you speak about this English woman. Her father loved her too much. Her mother didn't love her at all. She was just now realizing, she said, that her mother had emotionally fucked her up. So this is a sort of like cheerful bar conversation or whatever. And just occasionally that woman says to the group, okay, my mother fucked me up, and speaks about something she has sort of like come to realize after therapy, etc. And you describe how shocked you were, you and a fellow Malaysian student friend who was at the table and was extremely embarrassed about that openness of speaking about family. And then your friend says to this English person, but it's your mom you're talking about.
Yeah.
So there's this sense of like, it reminded me, I have to say, about the commandment, honor thy father and thy mother, which is an important element as well of your identity.
For us, it was just a question of the cultural difference. And I don't mean the cultural difference in terms of East and West. I mean the cultural difference in terms of long established families with a certain relationship from one generation to another, and others who come from immigrant families like us, like ours, where basically the rupture between one generation to the next is so brutal that our parents never talk about anything. I grew up in a big, you know, Chinese family. People are always arriving in the city to stay with us from the countryside. And they would be, you know, distant cousins, distant aunts, uncles. And so many of them would have what I now recognize to be mental health problems. They would be crying in their rooms. All the men in my father's side of the family were at some point in a psychiatric hospital, at some point tried to kill themselves, some point several of them did kill themselves. And this was never, ever talked about, ever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they were just referred to as, in passing, like so-and-so is sick.
Yeah.
But no one ever talked about how this made them feel, how much pain they had inherited from having had to leave China as a 10-year-old with no money. The pain of having been arrested because they were suspected to have been a communist for no other reason than they were ethnically Chinese in the 50s and 60s and spent like 10 years in jail without recourse to the legal system. So all these things happen all the time. And if they were to tell me why they were sad because of something that happened to their parents, they would have to tell me the reason behind it. Mm-hmm. And the reason behind it was something they really did not want me to know. Mm-hmm. They didn't want me to know those things because they didn't want me to feel, in this new, rapidly developing Malaysia of the 1980s, they did not want me to know that I was in any way different from anyone else.
Mm-hmm. And regarding the experience of an immigrant, although you didn't know it as a child, you were living as an immigrant in Malaysia, grew up like an immigrant, and then you went on to Europe, and you still are in a certain way. I don't know, would you consider yourself an immigrant today, or do you think that because of your educational status, professional success, etc., you have somehow grown out of that condition?
No, I mean, I'm still an immigrant. I mean, there's no way, but I think there's so many kinds of immigrants. I mean, there are immigrants who, you know, who arrive in the back of a lorry with nothing. And so I'm not in that class of person. So when people ask me what it feels to be an immigrant, I'd say I can't answer in Europe because, you know, I'm a writer. So that gives me a certain protection against certain realities. But yeah, I can still certainly speak universally. I think the most basic elements of being an immigrant, which are that you're really constantly trying to reconstruct an identity for yourself. You're always having to adjust to the outside world. And part of this comes from the fact that your family has been through a lot in order for you to be where you are. And the position where you are now is considered by your family to be a place of stableness and success and security. But in fact, very often it's not that. You know, talking about the first contact I had with Britain that I talk about in the book is when someone from a university was talking about their family and their ancestors. And they said they were very, very surprised that people had so little knowledge about their ancestors.
Yeah.
And for example, he said, I'm always very surprised when people don't know the maiden names of their four great-grandmothers. Mm-hmm. And it was really striking to me that basically the bourgeoisie basically is obsessed by its genealogy. It's the people spend all their time drawing up family trees. Aunt so-and-so married uncle so-and-so, and this came from... Everyone has family trees. Whereas in my family, there was nothing. I didn't even know who my great-grandparents were. Mm-hmm. Never mind their names. I actually literally don't know who they were. My parents don't know who their grandparents were. They really have no idea.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of like generalizing your experience or trying to think about the category of the immigrant in a multi-contextual way, because as you say, there are all sorts of ways of being an immigrant and different cultures you originate from, etc. What was your sense, or was there, to ask more openly, a sense of solidarity that you developed or felt between you and other immigrants in Britain, for example? Or
I mean, you know, there's this cultural solidarity. I mean, if you meet other Malaysians and, mm-hmm. or Singaporeans, then yeah, there's assumed familiarity. But, you know, if I went into a Turkish store, I didn't automatically assume that I knew where the other person came from and what it took for them to get there.
Yeah.
And I think it's very dangerous, I think, to speak about, you know, the universal immigrant experience in terms of what it's like to be an immigrant in Britain or Germany. I think those differ. But I think all those people would still have issues with parentage. They would still have issues with communication, with language, with how they situate themselves within their parents' culture,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to their own, which is a kind of a more hybrid culture.
And what about your experiences then as a writer? You speak about how strange it was for you after graduation when some people of your university went on and had jobs at banks, at law firms, etc. And there was a group of people who didn't know what to do, and they said, oh, I'm just going to move to London and finish my novel.
To me, it just seemed to be the most bourgeois thing ever. I mean, mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine. I had no idea. I had no model for how that could happen. And these people kind of, they knew things as if by heart, that it was part of their being. And it wasn't until later on that I realized that they had parents who were writers, or they had parents who, you know, university professors or journalists. And so they knew what the system was. But they would say things like that, and they would say things like, first of all, they would use nouns as verbs. So mm-hmm. they would say, oh, I'm going to summer in France. So, and the idea of, where are you summering? And to me, the idea of spending a whole block of time in any one place like that just seemed to, it just spoke of an experience of life that I had never, ever been exposed to. And the thought that someone might just be able to go to a place.
Yeah.
With all the connotations of summer and finish a book.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, how the hell does that happen? The idea of getting to the end of term and not working for me, because I had to work to sort of earn my bills. And so I had to figure all that out. And in fact, you find out that actually there's other people in your position. So it's not that difficult. But it's just, you know, from my kind of background, mm-hmm. it seems so remote and so foreign.
Yeah. So you also actually got a degree in creative writing, right, later on. And your literary career starts then, let's say, in the early 2000s. And there's a very funny passage from Strangers on a Pier that is also revealing about the literary system and literary fashions, etc. So when you attend, this is the situation, you've just graduated and you're trying to become a writer, but you have no idea how to become one. So you tell that you attend a workshop led by a well-known writer, and I quote, here is some of the advice I scribbled down that day in a notebook I'm soon going to consign to the recycling bin. Never be direct or obvious. No one is interested in misery memoirs. If you have to write about trauma, try being oblique. Maybe use an animal narrator or an inanimate object like a chair. So this was the advice that was given to you.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, but it's absolutely true. And I think this is really true of the Anglo-American publishing scene. And the term misery memoir is so insulting and mm-hmm. so reductive. So if you talk about anything that's painful, anything that involves trauma or tragedy, people say it's just a misery memoir, which means that vast amounts of literature is produced about purely kind of incredibly low stakes, emotional, very, very bourgeois situations, which to me mean nothing. And I can't help but feel that it's a way of excluding people from the literary canon. It's a way of excluding, for example, a lot of immigrant writers, you know, people mm-hmm. who are writing about things that are necessarily difficult, necessarily painful. And that if you want to write them, I was literally told by someone that maybe you can use as a narrator, this is really true, a chair or like a table. Because this is for my first novel, The Harmony Silk Factory, which is a story about war and what people have to do to survive war.
Mm-hmm.
Someone told me it's too direct, it's too confrontational. Maybe instead of a person, you might want to use as a narrator the chair in the house that witnesses everything that happens. I thought, who's going to fuck about a chair? I don't care about the chair. What I care about is people. But it just so happens.
Don't you think the literary world has evolved quite a lot?
I think
it has
evolved a little bit. Uh-huh. I really don't think it has evolved a lot. I think if you look at the majority of books that are published today, they're still incredibly boring bourgeois books. I feel this, I say this in all sincerity. Mm-hmm. I think most books published today, the overwhelming majority of books, are still about people facing existential difficulties in a middle-class setting.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, there's absolutely the majority of books.
Yes, I agree. In what concerns the really mainstream and big market.
I'll give you another example. When my last novel came out, We the Survivors, mm-hmm. it's based on someone like my cousin who was never very good at school. He was always in and out of trouble with the police, worked in a factory. He got a succession of really bad jobs and got into trouble. Anyway, it's about the life of a kind of a very humble Malaysian Chinese man who then he has a series of jobs to try and make ends meet. Mm-hmm. And when I did the interviews in Britain and in America, almost every single journalist said to me they found it incredible, so interesting, because it's the first novel they've ever read where people go to work, where people actually find themselves in the work setting. And that made me think, actually, this is true. In most novels, no one actually even goes to a middle-class job. They don't go to a bank. They don't go to an accounting firm. They certainly don't go to a fish farm, which is where he works most of the time. They don't work in a crappy restaurant, which is where my character does. Because writing is produced by bourgeois people, generally for other bourgeois people. So when you've come from outside the system, and of course, I now inhabit a very, very bourgeois environment. Mm-hmm. I have become that person. But all the people I'm surrounded with, all the people I grew up with, and all the people about whom I write and for whom I write are still living those lives. And it seems to me entirely normal to write for those people. And it's not until I come up against a journalist who says, wow, it's so interesting, people actually have jobs, that I think, my gosh, it's really, really interesting that I had just how middle class the literary world still is.
Okay, last question then. You don't feel that you're sort of like, as the writer with the personal background you have and the story you have, etc., do you sometimes feel pushed, au contraire, to what you just said, to a place where everything anyone always wants to hear from you is the misery memoir?
No, I think they're delighted when I don't write about misery. My publishers are, who I love, but if you're here. And you can see the difference in reaction. Mm-hmm. My forthcoming novel, no one dies in it, no one gets sacked, and everyone's delighted. It's just people falling in love. It's really lovely. And it's true. I think, the reason why when you asked me what I wanted to talk about, I said I wanted to talk about being a traitor, is I feel that almost no matter what I do, I'm going to be seen to be letting down one side or the other.
Yes.
Even asking my parents about stories, it felt to me as if I was betraying them. Mm-hmm. Writing that felt like an act of betrayal. Why am I taking their story and making it public?
Yeah.
And yet it's something I feel I have to do.
Good. I think that's a good place to end. Thanks so much, Tesh Orr.
Thank you. Thank you, Owen. Thank you.